Welcome to Season 3 of the Sagebrush Trail. I'm Mardell, and I want to share with you a fascinating true account of what it was like to journey west in a covered wagon. Here is Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell. Chapter 1, Forsaking the Old in Quest of the New. We left the west bank of the Missouri River on May 17, 1857. Our objective point was Sonoma County, California. The company consisted of 37 persons, including several families and some others, the individuals ranging in years from middle age to babies, 11 men, 10 women, and 16 minors, the eldest of the party, 49, the most youthful, a boy 2 months old, the day we started. Most of these were persons who had resided for a time, at least not far from the starting point, but not all were natives of that section, some having immigrated from Indiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Virginia. We were outfitted with 8 wagons, about 30 yoke of oxen, 50 head of extra steers and cows, and 10 or 12 saddle ponies and mules. The vehicles were light, well-built farm wagons, arranged and fitted for economy of space and weight. Most of the wagons were without brakes, seats, or springs. The axles were of wood, which in case of their breaking could be repaired en route. Chains were used for deadlocking the wheels while moving down steep places. No lines or halters of any kind were used on the oxen for guiding them, these animals being managed entirely by the use of the ox whip and the ox word. The whip was a braided leathern lash 6 to 8 feet long, the most approved stock for which was a hickory sapling as long as the lash, and on the extremity of the lash was a strip of buckskin for a cracker, which, when snapped by a practiced driver, produced a sound like the report of a pistol. The purpose of the whip was well understood by the trained oxen, and that implement enabled a skillful driver to regulate the course of a wagon almost as accurately as if the team were horses with the reins in the hands of an expert yahoo. An immigrant wagon, such as described, provided with an oval top cover of white ducking, with flaps in front and a puckering string at the rear, came to be known in those days as a prairie schooner, and a string of them drawn out in single file in the daily travel was a train. Trains following one another along the same new pathway were sometimes strung out for hundreds of miles, with spaces of a few hundred yards to several miles between, and were many weeks passing a given point. Our commissary wagon was supplied with flour, bacon, coffee, tea, sugar, rice, salt, and so forth, rations estimated to last for 5 or 6 months, if necessary, also medical supplies and whatever else we could carry to meet the probable necessities and the possible casualties of the journey, with a view of traveling tediously but patiently over a country of roadless plains and mountains, crossing deserts and fording rivers, meanwhile cooking, eating, and sleeping on the ground, as we should find it, from day to day. The culinary implements occupied a compartment of their own in a wagon, consisting of such kettles, long-handled frying pans, and sheet-iron coffee pots as could be used on a campfire, with table articles almost all of tin. Those who attempted to carry the more friable articles, owing to the thumps and falls to which these were subjected, found themselves short in supply of utensils long before the journey ended. I have seen a man and wife drinking their coffee from one small tin pan, their china and delftware having been left in fragments, to decorate the desert wayside. We had some tents, but they were little used, after we learned how to do without them, except in cases of inclement weather, of which there was very little, especially in the latter part of the trip. During the great rush of immigration into California subsequent to 1849, from soon after the discovery of gold until this time, the usual date at which the annual immigrants started from the settlement borders along the Missouri River was April 15th to May 1st. The spring of 1857 was late, and we did not pull out until May 17th, when the prairie grass was grown sufficiently to afford feed for the stock, and summer weather was assured. At that time, the boundary line between the states and the plains was the Missouri River. We crossed that river at a point about halfway between St. Joseph and Council Bluffs, where the village of Brownville was the nucleus of a first settlement of white people on the Nebraska side. There the river was a half a mile wide. The crossing was effected by means of an old-fashioned ferry boat or scow, propelled by a small stern-wheeled steamer. 2 days were consumed in transporting our party and equipment across the stream, but one wagon and a few of the people and animals being taken at each trip of the ferry boat and steamer. From the landing we passed up the west shore 20 miles, seeing occasionally a rude cabin or a foundation of logs, indicating the intention of preemptors. This brought us to the town of Nebraska City, then a beginning of a dozen or 20 houses on the west bank. Omaha was not yet on the map, although where that thriving city now stands, there existed then a settlement of something over 100 persons. From Nebraska City, we bore off northwesterly, separating ourselves from civilization, and thereafter saw no more evidence of the white man's purpose to occupy the country over which we traveled. There was before us the sky-bound stretch of undulating prairie, spreading far and wide, like a vast field of young growing grain, its monotony relieved only by occasional clumps of small trees, indicating the presence of springs or small watercourses. Other companies or trains from many parts of the country, especially the middle states, were crossing the Missouri at various points between St. Louis and Council Bluffs, most of them converging eventually into one general route as they got out on the journey. It is perhaps impossible to convey a clear understanding of the emotions experienced by one starting on such a trip, leaving friends and the familiar surroundings of what had been home, to face a siege of travel over thousands of miles of wilderness, so little known and fraught with so much hardship and peril. The earlier immigrants, gold hunters, men only, men of such stuff as pioneers usually are made of, carried visions of picking up fortunes in the California gold mines and soon returning to their former haunts. But those who were going now felt that they were burning all bridges behind them, that all they had was with them, and that they were going to stay. Formerly, we had heard that California was good only for its gold mines, that it was a country of rocks, crags and deserts, where it rained ceaselessly during half of the year and not at all in the other half. But later we had been told that in the valleys there was land on which crops of wheat could be grown, and that cattle raising was good on the broad acres of wild oats everywhere in the cow counties. It was told us also that there were strips of redwood forest along the coast, and these trees, 100 to several hundred feet in height, could be split into boards 10 to 20 feet long for building purposes, and that this material was to be had by anybody for the taking. Some said that the Spanish padres, at their missions in several localities near the Pacific shore, had planted small vineyards of what had come to be known as the Mission grape, which produced enormous crops. Another report told us that other fruits, including the orange and lemon varieties, so far as tried, gave promise of being valuable products of the valley and foothill soils. Such stories gave rise to a malady called California fever. It was contagious and carried off many people. Our first camp was on the open prairie, where grass grew about 4 inches high, and a small spring furnished an ample supply of water. Firewood we had brought with us for that night. The weather was very fine, and all were joyous at the novelty of camping out. On or about the 8th day, we came to the Platte River, broad, muddy stream, at some points a mile or more in width, shallow, but running rapidly between low banks, its many small islands wholly covered by growths of cottonwood trees and small willows. From these islands we obtained from time to time the fuel needed for the camp, as we took our course along the river's southerly shore. Occasionally added to the contents of the grub wagon, by capturing an elk or deer that had sought covert in the cool shade of these island groves. Antelope also were there, but too wary for our huntsmen. We forded the Platte at a point something like 150 miles westward from its confluence with the Missouri. There was no road leading into the river, nor any evidence of its having been crossed by anyone at that place. We were informed that the bottom was of quicksand, and fording therefore dangerous. We tested it by riding horses across. Contrary to our expectations, the bottom was found to be a surface of smooth sand, packed hard enough to bear up the wagons, when the movement was quick and continuous. A cut was made in the bank to form a runway for the passage of the wagons on the water's edge, and the whole train crossed the stream safely with no further mishap than the wetting of a driver and the dripping of a wagon into place deep enough to let water into the box. Boarding the Platte consumed one entire day. We camped that night on the north shore. The train continued along the general course of the river, about 400 miles as far as Fort Laramie, through an open country, in which there was an abundance of feed for the animals, but where wood for fuel was scarce. Join me next week for more Western adventure. In Crossing the Plains, Days of 57, by William Audley Maxwell, here on the Sagebrush Trail.